Hello, everybody. This is Addison Schoenland from Air Insight. Ernie and I are very happy to have you with us today. We are recording this event, and if you're uncomfortable with us recording it, please get off the Zoom. We won't be offended. I have muted everybody so that we can be effective in terms of the sound and background noises. And I want to hand over to Talinda Larson. Dr. Larson is the unmanned expert and editor at Air Insight. And I'm now going to hand off to Talinda. Now I have to find her unmute her. Over to you, Talinda.
Thank you so much, Addison. And I also thank Ernie for this opportunity to present to everyone today the webinar on UAS and UAM COVID-19 and beyond. For those of you who are not familiar with remotely piloted, optionally piloted, and autonomous flight industry, also known as drones, today's webinar will enlighten you on the use cases for drones in emergency response and package delivery. Drones and electric vehicle takeoff and landing aircraft, which are called eVTOLs, are the fastest growing sector of aviation. There are now more than 600,000 small drones in commercial operations today in the United States. And you compare that to 250,000 piloted aircraft in the United States. Forecasts for the eVTOL, or urban air mobility aircraft, are for 430,000. Let me repeat that, 430,000 aircraft over the next 20 years. In September, I joined Air Insight to incorporate this new vital growing sector of aviation into the Air Insight portfolio. Today, our guests are Romeo Dorshore, who is the Senior Director of Public Safety and Integration for DJI. Addison or Ernie, would you progress the slides, please? There we go. Oh, yep, take it to the pictures. Okay. So there's Romeo. He is Senior Director of Public Safety Integration for DJI. Again, for those of you not familiar with this sector of the market, DJI is a Chinese company which has 85% of the total world market for small drones. He was previously with NASA, and in his role with DJI, he is truly a visionary and leader. He is listed as one of the 25 most influential people in the commercial drone industry and one of the 7 most influential drone visionaries in emergency response. This sector of the industry really came to age during Hurricane Harvey, where finally, the whole industry became really a reality between 2013, 14. But then the FAA created the regulations in 2016 that designated a way of these aircraft to be used as drones to be operated commercially. And it was under these regulations that we were able to really demonstrate how drones in the recovery from Harvey can be used as very essential tools in emergency response. And our second presenter today is Michael Zarn, who had a vision, talking about visionaries, had a vision several years ago to create a network for drone deliveries, starting with Canada. And right now, he has recently been able to launch that vision into a reality. So he will provide us a look at drone delivery and future plans for Canada and beyond. So with that, let me turn over the presentation to Romeo to give us an overview of how these essential small drones have been used in emergency response.
Thank you so much to Linda. I really appreciate it. Ernest and Edison, thank you for having me. Welcome, good morning and good afternoon to everyone. I have a big story to tell with a lot of visuals, so let's get right to it. And this really is about how drones are being utilized right now during this really global pandemic. And so I wanted to give you a little bit more insight into what we are seeing being done, the challenges that come with it, but also the good that has come with it. So let's go to the next slide. In 2019, I released what's called the Disaster Relief Program. And that was meant to help local areas and regions after or during a natural disaster. I had deployed to multiple of these events, including the big wildfires here in California over the last 3 years. And drones were an essential tool during all of those. But I also realized that a lot of departments come together from fire to law enforcement, bringing their drones in an unstandardized way. And that kind of made it more difficult to be effective. So today, on the next slide, I wanted to put together a program where we can support regional events, you know, like your wildfire, earthquake, your hurricanes, flooding, the tornadoes, and then support those local areas with not only hardware, but also support on the ground as well as support in the background. The first activation of this program really happened early in March at the Nashville tornado. Exxon, the body cam manufacturer, led a team of law enforcement agencies there to help after the impact of the tornado. And then just a couple weeks later, we were in the midst of this pandemic, and I started working with the team to scale out this program from just a regional level support to a national level program. And we opened it up for departments to apply to get some of our hardware, and we got several hundred applications from across the US. Every single one was reviewed, and we started deploying hardware by the very early timeframe of April. So overall, we have been able to support 45 departments across the entire United States. We were trying to not only review every application in regards to what are they trying to do, but also are they in an area that will be of impact. 22 police departments, 9 fire departments, 8 county sheriff offices, 3 state patrols, and 2 county public safety agencies, as well as 1 hospital we were able to support through this program. On the next slide, during that time in late March, early April, we were also trying to estimate which areas are going to be impacted more by this virus. And obviously we are drone experts, not virus experts, but the data that was available at the time allowed us to really put some focus on certain areas and make sure that those areas are taken into consideration when we made those drones available to those public safety agencies in those particular regions. What's very important is, if you're thinking about deploying a new technology, you should go through a thinking process. And Vee Robotics put a really good flowchart together that kind of outlines at least the minimum basic questions you should ask before you start deploying, even more so during a pandemic that we're seeing right now. You've got to talk to the stakeholders and the people that benefit from the use of the technology. Are there other tools already available? If so, then use those. Don't bring in the new technology. And do you understand the legal, the privacy and policy framework? And if you can go through that chart and you end up at the orange box, then it may be a good idea to utilize this new technology. And this is basically based on the Humanitarian Drone Code of Conduct that we established in about 2014, about 60 entities led by UAVators came together to really talk about the proper use of drones during these humanitarian missions. And it was DJI was part of that group, and we defined those best practices and the code of conduct so that we really utilize this technology with the most benefit, impact, and the least fallout as possible. So on the next slide, we part of this whole program also is a paid forward piece. Every department that we supported has to agree that they help collect good information on use cases, best practices, also share what worked and what didn't work, so we can release that information across to other departments so that they don't have to reinvent the wheel, because resources are already very thin. Why make everyone try to learn something when we could share information? And that has really been very beneficial. On the next slide, I give you a little bit of statistics. That to date, that was by the end of the week prior, there were 442 COVID-19 related missions, which is a pretty high number, and we will continue to gather data so we can do an after-action review with all the stakeholders involved to really also make recommendations to the industry as well as to the FAA on what did work, what needs to change, how can we be more effective. Now, one of the really good use cases came out of Chula Vista Police in Southern California. As you may know, we have a very high density of homeless population here in California. It's a community at risk, and some of them live in areas that are very hard to access, especially in the Chula Vista area with all the canyons. So they staged a service location at one of the entrances to the canyon. They used one of the drones with a speaker to fly and provide health messages in English and in Spanish, letting them know that, hey, please come to the staging area. We have free services here. We have a hygiene kit. We have some food, face masks. And so they were able to get a message to this at-risk population in a much faster and effective way. And in fact, if we go to the next slide, they were able to cover 8 square miles in a time of 3 hours. And what would have taken 2 days by foot. So a tremendous impact. And also the mitigation risk factor here is very, very big, because we're not having to send somebody now down these canyons, potentially getting injured or getting too close, bringing potentially even COVID-19 into an area. So a tremendous benefit. And they have been doing this now week after week and reached more and more of this at-risk population. In Fremont, California, we saw the use of drones to pre-plan some of these mobile testing sites. And their concern were that they would have long vehicle lines and walk-up lines. So what they did is they utilized drones to create orthomosaic maps. By taking a series of images and stitching them together, you get really an at-scale map of your environment so you can do proper measurements and start planning. So they were able to plan the traffic line, the walk-up lines. Once the test site was open, they would utilize, again, the drone with the speaker to give information on estimated wait time and really keep people informed on what is happening, you know, a mile ahead of them because they were sitting in traffic. Very, very helpful information and use case. In Linn County, for example, we saw a very different approach of drones being used. And that is they created a delivery device by use of everyday items. This big gulp cup with some strings attached to it and a mechanism that if the cup touches down, it hangs below the drone, it can drop medicine or gloves or whatever is inside that cup right in front of a porch or onto a balcony to really mitigate exposure risk to both ends. And this is the kind of use case that I love out of public safety. They utilize items that are available to create a solution that can make life easier for everyone involved. It's definitely not as sophisticated as what Michael will be talking about, but this is in times like we are right now, a very easy and safe way to just do a small delivery of something. Here again, you can see what it looks like. Very handy, can come in very handy. Contra Costa County here in California, they had a field hospital that was going up, a station with about 250 beds. They again used the mapping functionalities of drones to not only map the entire area, but then also in post-production utilize it as a tool to outline ingress and egress points, as well as then once the hospital got into operation, use the drone to do aerial patrols of the perimeter around it to ensure that there is a safe environment, a contained environment. They also utilized the drone indoors before it was opened to fly through to create data sets of what it looks like, where the entrances and exits are. So just very helpful information. Again, this is a pre-planning tool which can be extremely helpful. Now, obviously, a lot of early lessons have already been learned. And one thing that really stands out is we got to identify the objective and benefits of the utilization of any sort of new technology, especially when it comes into the realm of public safety and medical help. You got to think about the public and media perception, and that differs regionally. What may be okay in one country may not be okay doing in a different country. And that is extremely important to understand, especially working right now in a global pandemic. We're seeing use cases in Asia or in India that we would not be doing here in the United States or in Europe. And that is a very, very important point to keep in mind. The operational procedures are always dynamic. That's very, very true in public safety. And that's also true when we utilize drones. The environment changes. Departments may have a drone team, but now because of COVID-19, they're resource strapped. Maybe some of the individuals are not available. So you got to be dynamic in your operational procedures. Sharing best practices helps everyone, because together we're learning and together we're eliminating the need to reinvent the wheel. After action reports are extremely helpful, because we gotta learn from lessons learned and gotta improve upon our procedures and deployments in the future. And obviously, we can only do that if we properly standardize not only how we are utilizing the technology, but also training and, of course, regulations. There are some resources that will be available to you: the Humanitarian Code of Conduct and the Best Practices in Humanitarian Missions. Also, we geofence our drones, meaning if you are trying to fly it in a restricted airspace, you will not be able, or you're not able to fly into restricted airspace. However, public safety, they will have a COA certification of authorization from the FAA to operate in potential difficult airspace environments, and they need to have their drones unlocked. So we have a procedure about all of that. Our latest report on the COVID-19 use cases will also be available, and there is the COVID-19 deployment survey for entities that are utilizing drones right now to share their information and data that will go into our after action review. So what we did, or what I did, is I put together these QR codes that one can use a cell phone to just scan the code with the regular camera, and it gets you to that particular website or to that particular file. And obviously, this will also be available post webinar. So here is the Humanitarian Code of Conduct. And I think if we go further, the code may pop up. Maybe it will not pop up, but it is there. Those documents, I'm sure the team will make links available so that if anyone is interested can get those information. These are the information how to get unlocked. We can move forward to the next slide. The next slide should then be our use case document. I think that one is the most interesting one. Let's go one more slide forward, please. But anyway, the links will be available to all of you, I'm pretty sure. And this concludes my portion. Hopefully this was able to give you a little bit of insight what is happening right now with drones in COVID-19 here in North America.
Thank you so much, Romeo. Very interesting to hear how things have been developing and how quickly the drone community has responded to this need in society for alerting people about managing crowds, delivering products, mapping out to help with hospitals. It certainly is an invaluable tool in fighting the COVID-19. So now our next presentation is from Michael Zahar, who is president of Drone Delivery Canada. First, we're going to watch a video, a quick little video to help you understand what Drone Delivery Canada is all about. So if Addison or Ernie, if you would launch the video, please.
I will do that. If I could remind the audience that for Q&As, we typically take our questions through the chat mechanism that's at the bottom of your screen. So if you have some questions for Romeo or Michael later, while you think of them, you can type a chat message and we'll clear those as we once we reach the Q&A section. So before you forget those ideas, if you want to jot them down in the questions, we're happy to accommodate that.
Oops, we don't have volume.
Sensitive, struggling with delivery in remote locations, costly last mile logistics, missing out on untapped markets? Reduce your shipping cost, improve operational efficiency, and uncover new revenue opportunities while never sacrificing on reliability. The last mile can define a company's profit or loss, and only one solution truly rises above the rest. Drone Delivery Canada is a logistics management company that offers a turnkey drone delivery, providing you with hardware, software, and services, and is the first drone logistics company to achieve compliant operator status by Transport Canada. Employing a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week operations control center, DDC's flight management software has the capability to monitor and manage all of your deliveries globally. Our preferred business model is commercial deliveries to predetermined locations, where your cargo will travel without the requirement for a paved road or the hassle of sitting in traffic. Think of it like a railway in the sky. Using our proprietary DroneSpot technology, Drone Delivery Canada ensures a safe takeoff and landing. With our expanding fleet of drones, Drone Delivery Canada addresses the bulk of your last mile delivery needs. With payloads up to 180 kilograms, covering distances of up to 200 kilometers, and with more drone models in development, Drone Delivery Canada is in a unique position to help you deliver in a way never before imagined. In today's market, Drone Delivery Canada is perfectly positioned for a wide range of applications in Canada and globally, with our all-in-one logistics solution for delivering goods across the last mile, in hard-to-access locations, and run times of the essence. Let's make the last mile the quickest and safest mile on your cargo's journey, reimagining the way you deliver. Drone Delivery Canada. Innovation is taking flight.
Very good. Thank you. So I guess if we now close out the presentations and we'll let Michael,
yes,
have a chance to talk a little bit about where you are now in the drone delivery life cycle of DDC and your relationships that you have with Air Canada and others to get the distribution out.
Sure, great. Thanks very much. And thanks very much for having me and welcome to the participants and hope you find this useful. So for us, a very different business model, obviously, and technology model than our friends at DJI. But nevertheless, before COVID-19, because I think that's going to be a new term before and after COVID-19 when people are talking in business now, but before COVID-19, our focus was on commercializing the business, which we did in 2019. You saw the Operations Control Center. We signed a partnership with Air Canada and started to sign revenue-generating customers, and then went live as a fully operational business earlier this year. So we're not a startup anymore. We're fully commercialized and operational. You know, given what's happening with COVID-19, it has certainly added some visibility to the industry overall, as well as to the company, and added another use case that really didn't exist before. For us, the use cases were typically one of two applications. The first being where access was difficult. So it could be a remote indigenous community. It could be a coastal community. It could just be where anywhere where access is difficult. It could be an oil rig out at sea, a ship out at sea, a large open pit mine where you needed to move cargo and parts for repairs around a vast expanse. Or the other application use case was where time was of the essence. So maybe you can get there, but sometimes cargo is time critical, whether it's pharmaceuticals or biologicals or radioisotopes or a number of different things. And in medical, time is often of the essence. So those were the use cases before COVID-19. And now with the pandemic going on, the third use case is to be able to move cargo and limit person-to-person contact. In many cases, we have communities in Canada, and I know it's the U.S. Case as well. I've seen some news in the U.S. with some of the Navajo communities and some of the First Nations communities in Canada, where they are starting to isolate themselves, but they need to maintain the supply chain so that they can bring in food, they can bring in medical supplies, they can bring in PPE. The issue with a lot of these communities is they are significantly more susceptible to the pandemic than communities that are not on a reserve in Canada or a reservation in the U.S. Because they have poor infrastructure, they have poor healthcare infrastructure, and in many cases, they have a lot of underlying health issues. They have a higher instance of tuberculosis, they have a higher instance of diabetes and these sort of things, which makes them particularly at risk. So we are seeing these communities in Canada, at least, and in the U.S., and I'm sure elsewhere, starting to self-isolate, really out of the need for self-preservation, but wanting to keep the supply chain open and also limit person-to-person contact. So cargo drones end up being the perfect application. So for us, we are in fairly advanced discussions with a number of First Nations communities in Canada, as well as healthcare, broadly defined healthcare. So it would be hospitals, it would be medical labs and testing labs, and also with the federal government through Indigenous Services Canada, which is the ministry that deals with Indigenous communities. So there are a number of projects that have been identified where the communities are self-isolated because of their concern with the pandemic, but want to maintain supply chain. So there's a number of those activities underway right now, and hopefully we'll have some announcements in the very near future. But for us, it has definitely raised the profile of the overall industry for delivery drones, not just for Indigenous communities, but overall. But there's definitely a focus on Indigenous communities because of the higher risk. So that's what we're seeing in Canada.
Would you talk a little bit about your aircraft? Do you make them yourself? What's the motor? What's the propulsion? And a little bit more about the performance test, because it's a pretty unique looking vehicle.
Sure. So they range in size from the smallest one, which is the Sparrow, which if you may have caught it in the video, and it's roughly 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet in physical size. It's electric. It has it has eight motors and rotors. It has a range of 30 kilometers and a cargo capacity of about 4.5 kilograms, which is about, I guess, 10 pounds. The next one up is the Robin, which is also electric, eight rotors. And it has a range of about 60 kilometers and a payload capacity of about 11.3 kilograms, which is about 25 pounds. And then you get to a point where batteries don't really make sense given the energy density that they don't really have. And you end up carrying so much battery weight, you don't really get the range or the capacity. So we go to a gasoline-powered drone, which is the Condor. So it looks like a helicopter. It's essentially a gasoline-powered helicopter, a little smaller than a traditional passenger helicopter, but nevertheless, same operational parameters. And it will go 200 kilometers and carry cargo of up to 180 kilograms, about 400 pounds. So that's really a game changer when you want to move large quantities of PPE or medical supplies or even food, and you want to move them long distance, whether it's pandemic related or it's humanitarian relief during a natural disaster, or even just regular e-commerce or postal mail. So the smaller ones tend to be more medical applications and these sort of things, and the larger ones are more bulk cargo. So that's what we're seeing in our portfolio today.
So are they remotely piloted or autonomous?
They are all autonomous. So you may have caught in the video our operations control center room. So it's like a NASA kind of room. And the system runs unmanned automatically. And we monitor projects globally from that room. So there's always a human being 24/7, 365, monitoring any of the routes and drones and projects globally. And then if there's an issue in the airspace, say for instance, there's another aircraft that declares a mayday, there's an emergency and air traffic control wants everybody to clear out of the way, we can then take control of our drones manually from that operations control center and do whatever we need to do to deconflict the situation. We maybe go home or hover or change altitude, whatever we need to do to deconflict the situation. But otherwise, the system runs automatically unmanned from point of origin to point of destination, from what we call a drone spot to a drone spot, which is an automated depot that's part of our system. So we're not really just about the drone. It's really an ecosystem of products. It's the drones. It's these automated drone spots that the drones fly between. It's an automated battery management system for the battery powered drones. And it's a software system called Flyte, F-L-Y-T-E, that wraps it all together, allows us to fly in active airspace. We can fly BVLOS and really brings it all together into one system.
And under what operating authority? How, do you have an airworthiness certificate? How are you doing this?
So in Canada, we've been a compliant operator for, I think, since the end of 2017. It's been quite a while, actually. And we have a special flight operations certificate. So we're allowed to fly in active airspace, controlled airspace. We're operating now with live projects commercially running. So we have been approved by Transport Canada for quite a while. We have flown in controlled active airspace in the United States, in New York, actually, in the airport in Rome, New York, with the FAA a couple of years ago. So we have some experience outside of Canada. Our focus is primarily in Canada because we're Canadian-based, but we are working on some developing projects outside of Canada as well, including the United States.
Very interesting. Ernie or Addison, do we have questions from the audience?
RG 67-01. Got you. Uncomfortable.
You want to mute?
When is the Condor going to be tested, and how long does the testing take for that?
As per the press release we sent out a couple of months ago or a couple of weeks ago, the Condor was originally targeted to be commercialized the end of the year. But because of a number of projects that we're talking to the government on, we're fast-tracking that with Transport Canada. So we anticipate the Condor will be commercially available probably, I would say, towards the end of the summer.
Awesome. Good to hear.
Yeah, we're looking forward. It'll be a game changer for sure.
Is Vision still on track to getting to get going?
I guess the audience doesn't know much about the specific projects, but so Vision, we're just waiting, as we said before, for a small permit from the municipality.
Perfect. Are there many other companies reaching out for the Sparrow, or is it mainly Condor right now?
So like I said, the Sparrow and the Robin are really more medical applications, I would say, and small e-commerce and mail. And given COVID-19, there are a lot of applications for that. So we're getting an equal number of government agencies reaching out for all of them, really. They're really different use cases, but all are relevant to the pandemic.
Okay, awesome. Thank you very much.
Anybody else? Questions? Going once.
Well, I can certainly continue to ask questions. I don't know. We have a Melanie who has clicked on. Does Melanie have a question she would like to ask? Barbara, do you have a question you would like to ask? Well, then let me continue with asking some questions. So let me ask Romeo. Romeo, with so much disruption in the supply chain with China being shut down, how has DGI been able to respond to the demand here in the United States? Are you doing any of the manufacturing production in the United States?
That's a good question, Lynn. And obviously, since this is a global pandemic, supply chain management has become a big challenge and one that sometimes really also needs out-of-the-box thinking. DJI has continued to do whatever is necessary to get product to where it's needed. And it just within the last 3 weeks, we've released two new platforms, one on the consumer side and one just last week on the enterprise, the commercial side. So obviously we feel confident and comfortable with the current situation to ensure that we can get product to the end users so that they can be utilized. Obviously it is a challenge for not only a company like DJI, but anyone that is serving not only globally, but in any country. So the team has done a tremendous job to keep customers supplied. Obviously, there are some delays. That's almost impossible to circumvent. But so far, we've done a really good job in keeping that line up and running.
There's a question in the chat box of, does DJI have delivery drones? Maybe talk about the product line, all the way down to your tiny, tiny little joint venture, Tello, all the way up to the latest Matrice.
Yes, so that's actually a very good question. So we have, in essence, two arms of the company. We have the consumer side, where we have these platforms for the hobbyists, the ones that just want to do this for fun, maybe create some cool videos. And those platforms are fairly small to medium-sized platforms. We have the tiniest one is the DJI Tello that in essence fits on your hand, takes off in your hand. It's more of an indoor drone, all the way up to the Inspire 2, which is a more professional drone for like the more serious bloggers, I would say. So that's on the consumer side. And then on the enterprise side, we're creating solutions for the more demanding commercial market. That can be public safety to utilities, inspection, agriculture, surveying. So definitely environments and areas that need a little bit more of additional features. And those platforms are not as small. They're starting out to be a little bit bigger and go up to the size of the M3 600, which is our biggest heavy lift, what we call drone. But they were not designed to do deliveries, although we're seeing some companies utilize some of the larger frames to do short deliveries. We've seen them in the wildfire areas when an air tank needs to be delivered to the front lines. So certain tasks they can be used for, but that's not our main focus. There are much better organizations like what Michael and his team are doing that are professionally and specialized in those very difficult environments of delivery. And that's not where we are in and where we put our focus on.
But still, there's a very strong commercial demand for these size aircraft that are all less than 55 pounds to come in under the FAA regulations. And there was a question on how long does it take? What do you need to become a pilot, a drone pilot? If you would answer it, Romeo, from the perspective of the less than 55 pound aircraft, and then Michael, if you would step in to what is needed to operate the larger aircraft.
That's also another good question. I mean, the commercial drone industry market is growing, and there are a lot of job opportunities today as well as in the future. So the FAA has done a first step in opening up that market to individuals to become part of it, a solution provider, a operator, and they have to go through what is called the 107 training class. And the 107 training class is in essence a first step into really getting an understanding of the airspace, crew management, risk assessment, type of questions and information that one needs to know in order to operate, in essence, an aircraft. It's a drone is defined as an aircraft, has limitations in altitude and distances that it can be flown right now, but it is an aircraft. And as such, an operator needs to understand the airspace environment and then also what kind of influences there are that could impact an operation, from weather to well-being to even alcohol. So this is an important step to do. It's a written test. There is no hands-on flying test just yet. That may be something in the future. But the basic need is to pass this test, and then you are a 107 certified operator that can utilize drones for commercial work. So that's right now the minimum standard that has been set.
Michael, what are the requirements for the larger aircraft?
In Canada, for consumer and professional applications, it's similar to what Romeo said. There's a basic test that you can do online with the government. If you're doing something that's more commercial related, you know, real estate videos or any of these sort of things, you need to get to an advanced license, which again is not that difficult, and you can do it through the government. It's fairly inexpensive. The world that we operate in is a completely different world. So our aircraft are federally regulated aircraft. They have tail numbers on them. And in some cases, especially for our larger drones, there are no government regulations that we need to meet in order for them to be certified. We are working with the regulator to define them ourselves. There are no Condor-sized drones out there. And there's not a lot of written regulations around BVLOS and these sort of things. So the interesting position that we're in is we're working with regulators, mostly in Canada, but around the world, to help define those. So for us, all of our engineers are certified to fly, but it's very different than manually flying a consumer or professional drone. The system needs to be certified, and it flies as an unmanned system, as we talked about earlier. So what's unique in our case is that there are no specifications, and we're writing our own specifications. We're using the Gerasora risk analysis to present all that information to governments around the world to be certified. So it's a very, very different process than a consumer or even a professional drone, the world that we have to live in.
Do you hire commercial manned aircraft pilots?
We have had some on staff, and we have had some ex-Air Canada pilots. We've had some ex-F-18 fighter pilots. We've had people from on staff. We have people who are ex-NASA, ex-FAA, ex-Transport Canada. So we have them on staff to help us with the work that we're doing. But the world that we live in is really an undefined, unprecedented world, and there is nothing to draw from. So we have to create it ourselves. So we actually created Drone Delivery Canada University. We have our own training curriculum. We have our own programs for our own staff to be trained and certified, for our customers to be trained to operate the system. So all of that we had to build from scratch, because there is no government regulation defining it really. And there really is no competitor that's working in the world that we're working in at the scale that that we're doing with the Condor, that sort of thing. So that's all been built. So some of those kind of titles that you mentioned and industries, we've drawn from them for their expertise in the curriculum and the training and these sort of things.
And are you manufacturing the aircraft itself in Canada?
Yes, for the most part. I would say there are components that we buy from third parties. You know, we're not a carbon fiber manufacturer expert. Our expertise is not in batteries and those sort of things. So those we'll buy from a third party. The majority of the rest of it, we design and build and test in-house. So all of the intellectual property and all the patents on the system and the drones are all of ours. Yeah.
And Romeo, are there any of the DJI products built here in the United States, or is it all in China and then shipped over here?
So for right now, our production lines are abroad. And we had tried to get a production line here into the United States. And unfortunately, that has taken much, much longer than anticipated. So as of right now, our production lines are abroad.
Do both of you see this market disrupting the classic traditional aviation markets, and in what ways?
Sure, go ahead, Romeo. Yeah.
Thank you, Michael. I think, yes, absolutely. And that's also good. You know, anytime new technology comes into the play, there are the ones that are very, very happy and excited about it. And there's the segment that's neutral about it. And then there's the segment that is not always convinced that this is the best way to go. That's normal. And any new technology has the potential to disrupt. What is exciting, and you are a great example of, you're a group that, you know, has been looking after the crude side of aviation for a very long time. And here comes this you know, little stepchild of an industry, and you're now bringing that in. And that's exactly what is needed, because we need to learn from all the experience that is out there that your side has, and we can bring in a different thinking to this side. I give you a very good example. My focus is on public safety, and initially a lot of the helicopter pilots in public safety, they were very concerned about the technology for two reasons. Number one, the safety reason. That's a very, very valid concern. We gotta integrate this new technology in ways that don't create additional risks. But the second reason was a more interesting one. The second reason was, well, this technology is going to steal my job. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was very fascinating, because yes, it's moving lightning fast. What Michael has created with Drone Delivery Canada is tremendous in a short period of time. But we're not quite there where we're just stealing jobs, because it's not going to replace a full-scale aircraft just yet. It doesn't put a pilot out of a job. In fact, it is creating additional and new jobs, and that needs to be understood and educated. So yes, it is disruptive in many ways. It's disruptive for government, because they have to create a whole different new environment and set of rules, because we have this crazy technology that can fly by itself and see the environment around it. And how do you regulate that? Technology always moves so much faster than regulations. It disrupts service models. It disrupts an entire industry. Yes, it does. But those disruptions are not necessarily negative, because it moves us as a society to just a next level. And if we can mitigate risks, if we can save lives, if we can do a job that has been done decades the same way, but we can now do it a little bit safer, a little bit faster, a little bit more effective, everyone wins.
Michael?
I would agree, everything that Romeo said. I mean, for us, what's interesting is we're not a drone company. We're really a systems company. So our system is actually airframe agnostic, meaning I could put my system on somebody else's drone, hypothetically. If somebody came out with a large cargo drone, I could actually put my system on a manned fixed wing, a Cessna or a Dash 8 or hypothetically a 787, or I could put my system on a manned rotary wing helicopter. So a military helicopter, for instance, I could put my system on that and now integrate that into my portfolio of drones. So we will see some disruption. But I think I agree with what Romeo said. I don't know that we're taking jobs away. In fact, I would say that we're adding jobs. We could be competing with some helicopter companies who might be flying repair parts or documents out to an oil rig. But we're actually in discussions with a lot of them who recognize us as an extension of what they can do. We can fly in different weather conditions. We don't need a pilot, a manned pilot. So we're actually augmenting what traditional cargo platforms can do today. So in that regard, I think we're adding jobs and adding revenue opportunities to the traditional platforms. I mean, in all honesty, if you look at an existing passenger flight, I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to guess 95% of the time it's on autopilot anyway. I don't see us replacing pilots on passenger planes anytime soon. Could the technology? Yes, absolutely. I mean, it mostly does it today. Would the regulator allow it? Would passengers allow it? I'm not so sure. It may change in the future. But our focus is really extending what's already being done through traditional means and really disrupting the industry in that regard.
Thank you. We have a question from the audience asking Romeo about commercial drone market outside of the United States, in Europe, Asia and other places. If you would talk about, is the U.S. leading? Are we lagging? Or what's going on in the rest of the world with the small, less than 55-pound drones?
Yeah, so the whole drone industry, it's a global phenomena. It has really caught on across the globe. And there are certain regions that have a better framework to operate under. When I initially started focusing on public safety in 2014, 2015, the environment here, the regulatory environment here in the United States was not as promising. At the time, it was extremely difficult to get what was called a 335. And so we couldn't really do what we're doing today. So I built a program in Europe with the European Emergency Number Association, and we created four pilot test sites to really test this and this technology in public safety, in fire and search and rescue operations, because it was just more user-friendly at the time in Europe. It has slightly changed in the meantime. The FAA has done some really great steps here in the United States to allow that commercial operator to become licensed. And we have to give the FAA a lot of credit as well. Oftentimes, the drone industry is very harsh on the FAA, but we also have to give credit to it. It's a federal agency that oversees a tremendously large portion of the airspace. And so obviously they want to do it right. But we're also seeing great progress being done in Latin America, in Africa. I was in Africa and South Africa last December, and it was fantastic to see how they are utilizing drones and the focus that they're putting into orthomosaic mapping from nature reserves to mines. to farms, to me, that's super exciting. And we don't see that all around the world. We see a lot of mapping being done here in the US, not so much in Europe just yet, especially on the public safety side, but other areas utilize technology in ways some certain areas don't. So it is fascinating to get a global perspective, but definitely Europe and the United States are somewhat on the leading front. And I shouldn't say the United States, I should say North America, because also Canada had a slow start, but is definitely now doing much more and at times even way ahead of what we're doing down here.
Michael, what do you see about the opportunities of the DDC kind of product outside of North America?
So obviously we're Canadian based and that was our initial focus, but we are working through Air Canada predominantly, but also directly in some instances with a number of potential partners and customers globally. So we have flown in the US, BVLOS a couple of years ago with the FAA. I just got back from India, working on a potential partnership there. We're also talking to companies in Africa. Outside of Canada, our model is typically to license the system to somebody else who wants to be the operator. Not exactly a franchise model, but something along those lines, where in Canada, we would actually implement the projects ourselves. So any kind of large airline, freight forwarder, logistics company, aerospace company, we're talking to a number of them outside of Canada to be partners, and then they would own the certification and they would be the operator, and we would enable them through a licensing fee and an ongoing monitoring managed service that we provide, and that would be our revenue stream outside of Canada. So there are a number of discussions underway definitely outside of Canada in really every continent.
Fantastic. Well, I thank you both. This has been a great webinar, a little bit different from the traditional Air Insight discussions. And let me turn it back to Addison to close out and tell us about next week.
Okay. Thank you very much, Talinda. Thank you very much to Romeo and Michael. That was actually fascinating. I got to say, I learned a lot that I didn't know about. And it was just like you said, Talinda. That's exactly what we needed. Next week, we have something very interesting. We have a panel. I don't know if Ernie's going to get the page up. Here we go. Hard-earned resilience, lessons from past crises. The idea, we struggled with the title because everybody's got a tweak on this. Our view on this, Ernie and I spoke about this quite a lot, and this is not the first crisis aviation has had. We've had lots of them. And the question is, how is this one different and what have we learned and how can we do something with that learning? And so what we've assembled is Dave Tritel, who is a senior VP at Zephyrus Aviation Capital. It's a leasing company based in Florida. Patrick Edmund, who is based in Ireland, will join us next week from the Green Isle to talk about, his background is obviously in airlines and airports. So he's got a good perspective. And then we have Nico Buchholz, who many of you may have heard of. He's been in the business for 30 years. With Rolls-Royce, Airbus, Lufthansa, and most recently with Bombardier. The reason we got assembled this group is because we want you to have the benefit of what looks like 90 plus years of experience. Perspective is what you need for the next decisions you have to going forward. So we look forward to seeing you all next week. And Ernie and I would like to thank you all again. If anybody has any questions, please contact me. And thanks again for being here with us today.
Thank you.